This morning I asked Gil for some suggestions on what to speak about this morning, and I've decided to choose the more challenging one, which is to speak about some of the things I learned from my 19 years as a Theravada monk, most of it spent in Thailand and traipsing around the world, and a bit about the transition to something that is often called lay life, although I really don't understand what that term means. And I'll explain more about that later. And sort of what I'm learning now in the transition and the path or lifestyle that I'm exploring and trying to learn from now. So I haven't spoken about this in a talk format, so I'm not sure how it'll come out. So please bear with me, and I hope parts of this will be of interest and use for you all. So I've been pondering a bit what, and I've done this before, what have I learned from monastic life? And I'll try to focus on a few main things, as well as some of the things I enjoyed about it. Early on, monastic life was just fun. It was kind of like being in Boy Scouts, and there are ways that I'm 49 now, and there are many ways I still haven't quite grown up, and that's also one of the little perks of monastic life. There's some ways you don't have to grow up in the usual way, and I don't mean that in a bad sense, although it does have its limitations. So being in a forest monastery, and there are a bunch of guys, there were women and nuns at Suan Mok as well. When I lived there, there were usually at least 100 people around, and at times that expanded. But the kind of base group was 30 monks, about 15 nuns, about 10 or 12 lay women and a few laymen. And then there would be always 20 to a couple hundred visitors. But in the early days, had a cool hut in the woods, and there's snakes and scorpions, and watching birds build a nest on the porch. And then one day a snake got the bird eggs. That was kind of depressing. That actually hatched. Watching massive battles of ants, you know, the little brown ants versus the big red ones, and monsoon rains, and what are called tree cats. They're a kind of big squirrel. There's one that liked to sit over my walking meditation path and drop pieces of fruit on me. Later, when I moved across the highway to a piece of land called Don Kiam, where I was more or less abbot, it was right next to a hill with lots of bats. And so bats would hang out in my kuti, and there was one that would occasionally pee in my face while I was asleep. So for some people that's gross, but I'm the kind of person who kind of thinks it's all cool. And some people think of monastic life as serious, and of course it has its serious aspects. But there's a lot about it that was fun. For me, another benefit was especially living with a well-known teacher who in Thailand was very revered, And also was a person lots of different people would come to visit. So over the years, I got to meet lots of fascinating people. Buddhists, Christians, Muslims, politically active, politically not so active, all kinds of different folks. And over the years, some of those have blossomed into to friendships, because Ajahn Buddhadasa was the primary advocate of interreligious dialogue and cooperation. He didn't he called it mutual good understanding and cooperation. For years he was the main proponent of that. And so when Christians, for example, would visit from other countries, if they wanted to meet a prominent Buddhist teacher, especially the Catholics, would send them down to Suan Mok, and I was usually the one who would look after them. And so I still have close friendships that have come out of that, those visits. Catholic monks who now live, one who lives in Britain, or I'm very close to a number of Filipino priests, Franciscan friars, and a bishop. So, as well as many fascinating ties in Thailand again, Ajahn Buddhadasa was an inspiration to Thai Buddhists who wanted, who didn't just want the meditation piece, but they wanted a thoughtful, critical thinking approach to Buddhism. And for many decades, Ajahn Buddhadasa was the primary person. So I got to meet some of the more a lot of the more important progressive thinkers and social activists in Thailand. And since I have a inclination in those directions, this was also quite nice. So that's one piece of monastic life that it's maybe not the standard thing. Some of that wouldn't have happened if I wasn't an American who spoke Thai well and was also a translator. But so a lot of this is my own personal experience of it, but that was a lot of fun and stimulating. Now, of course, monastic life isn't necessarily primarily about fun and stimulation. So there were other pieces as well. Probably the most important was that by being a monk, I was able to have a close and ongoing relationship to a teacher in a way that It's a very old model. It's in Thai Buddhism still the apprenticeship model that predates the Buddha was still available. And the old idea was if you wanted to learn something, you go and live with somebody who's a master at that. And the word ajarya or ajahn, which is often translated teacher, can also mean master in the old sense of master and apprentice. So in a way, I was able to apprentice myself to somebody who I deeply respected. And although it took me a while to realize it, who I also loved deeply. And it took me a long time to figure that was part of the pull. But there was somebody whose mind, his intellect, his presence, his groundedness, his understanding of Dhamma, and for me, most important, his unselfishness or his, I don't want to go so far as saying egolessness, but he was far enough in that direction and as much as anybody I've ever met. And so to be able to hang around somebody like that And then I was lucky. I showed up when a translator was needed, so that gave me a level of access that not everybody had. And so that, in retrospect, although I wouldn't have said this then, that was a lot of it for me. And so the teachings, Ajahn Buddhadasa was considered rather an intellectual, and some forest monks would use that pejoratively. Oh, he's a scholar or a philosopher. And in some corners of Thai Buddhism, those are dirty words. But he was called other things like Christian, communist, and Mahayanist. So labels get tossed around, and they often say more about the labeler than the labelee. But I personally wanted a form of Buddhism that was thoughtful and intelligent, and where it was okay to read books and think about things and think about the world in which we live, and yet do that with a grounding, and I feel a very solid grounding in the Buddha's teaching. The first thing, for the first year or two that I was able to have regular discussions with him, he just kept hammering away on the Four Noble Truths till I started to get what dukkha was about, because for a long time I felt, life's pretty good, I'm doing fine. I don't have a lot of suffering. And so it took a while for me to understand the more subtle meanings of dukkha, and that suffering isn't necessarily, massive trauma and heartbreak and catastrophe, but it's as I got into his teaching more and more, it's the subtle gnawing and friction of living life through an ego, living life always shaded and distorted by me and mine. So that and later I saw the pull, and I'll pick up on this in a little bit. A lot of it was the opportunity to be really close to somebody like that, and then to serve, both through Buddhism, but also I was inspired by friends who were Franciscan friars and others where the notion of service is strong. It's not always talked about a lot in Vipassana or Theravada circles, but that always seemed to me important. I was in the Peace Corps before I ordained, and it goes back to my childhood and my upbringing, which was largely Christian, Protestant. And so the as time went on, to have a life style in a situation where I felt I was able to be of ongoing service. Now, it's easy to idealize that and hide all the more self-serving agendas, and that's part of practice, to separate out the idealism of service or monastic life. And there is a lot of idealization, even romanticization. And part of practice is distinguishing that from what is really other ego rationalizations. So that relationship, and then the monastery Suan Mok was a teaching center. It wasn't primarily a meditation center. That was one of its aspects, especially when a large retreat center was built by the assistant abbot, or the acting assistant abbot, and then I was involved in running the retreats for a number of years. But that was just one corner of the place. It wasn't even, especially for the Thais, it wasn't the primary piece. It was a more broadly a teaching center, and teaching meditation was part of that. But teaching in all kinds of different ways, school groups, soldiers, policemen, doctors, social activists, farmers, different groups would come. And for me, it was inspiring and at times moving, and to have a part in that, because being the resident foreign monk who spoke Thai pretty well, most groups wanted to have me speak with them, if for no other reason than the entertainment value of how I would mispronounce words and also say things that most Thai monks couldn't get away with saying. And that's a whole nother piece I won't dwell on. But being a foreign monk in a place like Thailand is, it's a privileged position. We, in many ways, get the best of both worlds. Although this is changing or eroding, when I was, for much of the time I was a monk, well, this started changing in the late 80s, early 90s, monks were still quite revered and respected. But also being a foreigner was a novelty, and since Thailand wasn't colonized, there wasn't a lot of baggage of anti-Americanism. So it kind of got the best of both worlds, although there are some clear downsides to that as well. So a piece of this was then starting to, because of the service aspect, and Sun Mok was a place where work was encouraged. There are certain monasteries that are really focused on meditation. There aren't actually that many, but there are a few. But generally, there's more of a balance between some aspect of work, at least just to take care of the place. But Sun Mok, it was also teaching, or for me, teaching and translating. But there was sweeping, building, and other things. And so the work piece, it's still something I'm working on, that I, like most of you, come from a culture where people ask, you know, or we define ourselves a lot by what we do, which means our jobs. And a lot of our self-worth, as it seems to me, is defined by what we produce. I feel our culture is very accomplishment-oriented and production-oriented. And so it's interesting to bring that into a more laid-back Thai approach where work is valued, but it's contained more in a Dhamma way. And it's less about accomplishment, especially personal accomplishment, and more focus on doing work that's enjoyable, meaningful, and serves others. And for me, there's still a kind of, maybe not a conflict, but a rubbing together of these two pieces in my life, because there's still the desire to do or produce useful things, whether it's books or articles or teach retreats or whatever, or build cabins in the Wisconsin woods. It's so easy to fall into that needing to do something, needing to produce. And if, for me personally, if I'd been in a monastic situation where there was no outlet for that, I wouldn't have lasted very long. Some people will. They're different personality, different makeup. But I don't think I would have. I would have just been this kind of pent-up frustration, and I would have exploded or ran away or something. Sun Mok gave me an outlet for those things, but also some perspectives to be more mindful of it and to start to ask questions. you know, how much of this is service and how much of it is doing for doing's sake or some need to be seen as useful, which is not a bad thing, but it can be a source of a lot of suffering and anxiety doing something. And then, you know, was it good enough? Was it helpful enough? Do people appreciate it? And all that. So those are some of the things, and there are many more, and many very small ones that remain meaningful to me out of my monastic experience. Later on, something started to, you could say, awaken in me or become more conscious, which was the awareness how much connecting with people meant to me. And so maybe around my 14th, 15th year as a monk, I became aware of this. In retrospect, I can see it working all along, but it wasn't part of my mental model of what being a monk is. It wasn't about feelings and connecting and intimacy and stuff like that. But then I started to recognize that actually underneath a lot of what I was doing, or when I felt I had given a good talk, or often I felt good about what I was doing, it depended on connecting with people. And so I started exploring that more and more. And depending on your perspective, that became an important area for growth, or that's where I went down the tubes. And I haven't come to a firm conclusion which of those it was or both. But I'm quite happy where I am right now. But you never know. Because I had not all monks think this way. But there's a strong trend in monasticism. And it's not just Buddhist or Theravada. The whole monastic model is very wary of this connection stuff. Because, and later when I started to ponder disrobing, that became a big issue. But I'll get to that in a moment. But what I discovered was, I started noticing how my most active friendships were all with women. And nuns, Buddhist and Christian, and some women. And then it dawned on me that I was seeking a kind of emotional openness or intimacy. And so I tried it with monks, and the steel door kept coming down, even with some of my best friends. And a couple of them are still close friends, but not close emotionally. We were close in spending a lot of time together, sharing ideals and values, having worked together very closely. But when it came to talking about or even recognizing emotions, nope. And so that became a growing issue for me. And eventually, and this is my take, there's no way I could speak for all monks or all former monks or monasticism, but what in pondering this, I started to realize or at least come to the opinion that because in monasticism, and by the way, monasticism or monk comes from the word, the Greek word monachos and mono, which means single. And so the kind of idea of married monks, which we hear a little bit about in this country, is it doesn't compute really in most of Buddhism, except for Zen. And that has to do with the history of Zen in Japan, not in China. But in Buddhist and what I know of Christian monastic systems, celibacy has become such, and perhaps it always was, a defining characteristic. And later I came to the opinion that's one of the two defining characteristics of being a Buddhist monk. You're celibate and you're ordained into, the word club is a little bit unfair, but there is this guy's institution, and that, you know, the women are allowed some space, but it's definitely a patriarchy. And so being accepted into the formal institution or sangha or whatever you call it is one piece, because there are a lot of people who live very much like a monk but don't have that formal ordination piece. And then second is the celibacy. And in the conscious mind, the celibacy stands out a lot. And so much gets set up to protect celibacy. And especially in the male version, it seems somewhat different for women. But for the male version of monasticism, there's an attempt to protect celibacy. There's a lot of boundary about any kind of emotional closeness. And even close friendship is usually frowned upon. So this became a big contradiction for me. And along the way, I fell in love a couple times. And again, a lot of that's in retrospect. And, you know, some of them were, it wasn't any kind of relationship that would go anywhere, but an existing close relationship, friendship, then a bit of infatuation or falling in love. So as I became more and more aware of this, then at some point I had to make a choice. Either I just stop this looking for intimacy piece, because I was increasingly at odds with, or on, you know, too much on the edge of the communities I was part of. And monasticism is not much fun if you're always the odd person out. And I was already often the odd person out because of my socially engaged activities, because I was outspoken or had a big mouth, and to some extent because I was a foreigner. For the most part, for a while I was abbot of a largely foreign community. And foreign included Asian, Bangladesh, Malaysian, Japanese, but about half, and some Thai monks as well. But most of that was tolerable, but it was much more threatening and difficult that I was finding more emotional connection and fulfillment hanging out with nuns and women. And then when I started talking like a feminist or trying to bring that piece in, so there's, you can only do so much of that, and then it gets very uncomfortable. So, and not all of this, by the way, was going on very consciously. I'm part of a lot of this is when I made the decision to disrobe, I had to sort a lot of this out. And so I made the choice that at the stage of my life I was at 2.5, 3 years ago, I disrobed April 2 years ago, it was more important to explore what I phrased then and still do as intimacy than to remain part of this institution. That's probably the most important issue, but there are lots and lots of other things, including my own critiques of monasticism. But I'm not going to go into that now because it's just a habit. I critique everything. So it's not like monasticism is the main target of my critiques. The American government gets a lot more. But and various other things. So in the end, I decided that, and there was a relationship kind of open where do I step into this relationship or do I do what I'd done in the past, which is kind of be in this kind of murky gray area, and with some of the nuns who this kind of happened with, we've talked about it since, and it was on both sides. And it's interesting, but it's also very hard to process because the monastic model doesn't give you a way to think about, because it's not quite taboo, but it's definitely inappropriate. And so there's not a lot of, at least I didn't know of anywhere I could go for much help with this. So I was generally finding help outside the monastic system. And then that ended up being another piece for, well, if the people I'm confiding in and getting advice from are mainly not monastic, well, maybe that says something. And so those are some of the more important pieces of my choosing to disrobe. So then, what have I learned since disrobing? Some things were bouncing around in my head during the meditation. I'll see what I remember. One of them is that intimacy is a whole lot bigger deal than sex. Within the monastic system, as I've experienced both Thai and Western, the assumption is when a monk disrobes, it's for sex. And I've come to be rather ashamed of that view, because I'm still pretty sure it's predominant among monastics, at least the men. And it seems to me now extremely shallow. Sex is part of it, perhaps, at least it is in my case. But intimacy means a whole lot more than that. And so that's this being in an active relationship. My partner, Jo Marie, we live together. Liberation Park is our project together. It was already my project, and she's kind of slowly sharing it. And that's a whole difficult process, because I started out as the teacher. She's not a teacher. She says she doesn't want to be a teacher. So even just exploring what's potentially an imbalance or a messy power relationship has been delicate, but so far fruitful, and it's going well. But for me, the opportunity to be as open as possible in all dimensions around Dhamma practice, ideas and ideals, feelings, bodies, sexuality, sharing in a project together, for me it's brings a lot of happiness, contentment, and I feel like I'm growing in areas that I hadn't grown in before. And by saying that, I'm not blaming the monastic system, because it could very well be I wasn't ready to grow in these areas until my mid-40s. When I look back, I'm very glad I waited to get into relationship until I had outgrown some of the stuff I was doing in my 20s and maybe even my 30s. So at least being consciously in a relationship for me started at 47, which might be a little late, but I think I was more ready. And we'll see how that goes. So that's, I'm still exploring that one. Another big learning has been that modern so-called lay life is really hard. In monasticism, as I experienced it, it's very easy to get used to being taken care of. A lot of Thai culture is set up to take care of the monks. And this is something I was increasingly uncomfortable with while I was still a monk, seeing how some Thai women, their conditioning to look after the needs of monks was getting in the way of their own practice, because they couldn't focus on their own practice when a monk was around. And that became very uncomfortable for me if I was the monk. And so in some cases, by no means all, it seemed that having the monk as the main teacher and all that was an obstacle, at least for some people. On the other hand, if you're the monk, you benefit. You get good food, you people catering to you, doing stuff for you. It's easy to rationalize or justify that, at least in my case, by how hard we work, we live a simple lifestyle, we don't own anything. And I think there's a fair amount of truth in that, at least for many monks. But when you look at it from the monastic side, at least many of us, you're focused on, the support we need, because we choose, and sometimes monks forget, we choose to live within a monastic training system, or I chose for many years. And from that you see, there's the stuff you're not supposed to do, and you'll be censored by other monks and lay people if you do it. And so you see all the things you need help for, but it's easy to overlook how hard it may be for the people you're expecting or hoping will help you. So I lived in Chicago for the last couple years, and since disrobing, had a small center in Oak Park, Illinois, which is a rather affluent community, although most of the people who came to our place were not all that affluent. But it was an area with a lot of money, very nice houses, a lot of things happening. It's a good place to be in many ways. And people are pretty stressed out and extremely busy making ends meet, taking care of the kids, going on vacation and other stuff. And I don't fully understand it now, because I'm not really living that lifestyle. I don't have a job. I don't have an income or salary. I'm supported by Liberation Park, which is where the Dana goes. And so I don't have the financial responsibilities or the magic sign. Okay. Thank you. So I'll wrap up that one real quick. Well, that leaves time for one more. What else have I been learning? I'm not sure it's... I'll just close by saying, throughout the my last years as a monk, and especially around the time I was deciding to disrobe, which, by the way, for me happened quickly. I'm the kind of person, something ruminates subterraneanly and then it erupts and then I deal with it, and I deal with it pretty fast. So that period was about 2 months, 3 months, but in retrospect it was bubbling away for a long time. Something that's now important for me is I get labeled as a lay teacher, and that doesn't make sense anymore to me, because I see now, my view now is that Buddhism has been stuck for too long with a dichotomy between a monastic ideal based on the Buddha's time that hardly anybody can live. There are very few monastics nobody lives it the way it was in the Buddha's time. Some nowadays come reasonably close, and I don't mean this at all critically. Circumstances don't allow, especially in our society. On the other hand, very few of you probably match the householder ideal of the Buddha's time. And yet we still use that terminology, and I think are way too burdened with this kind of monastic or lay. And I think those terms are out. Monastic, the term has a use, but its meaning has to be reviewed. And I think the word lay is could be thrown away, especially in Buddhism, because the English word I don't think really fits the whole diversity and spectrum. At least I don't feel it fits what I'm trying to do, which is kind of a mix of some monastic elements and some lay, non-monastic, householder, whatever you want to call it, elements. And that's where I'm trying to explore right now with my partner and at Liberation Park, some way of being in the world that's not classically monastic, but is also quite far from the householder stereotype of that is still the poles by which a lot of things get framed. And so I would just as soon drop much of that frame, or at least review it carefully. So I've gone over by 1 minute. My apologies. Thank you for not getting up and leaving immediately.